The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening to The Big Show. Big weapons, big science, big data, and big dinosaurs this hour. We have a little trouble fitting it all in. We begin with the biggest of weapons, nuclear weapons, warheads, missiles, all the stuff that the president took pride in limiting through diplomacy in the nation of Iran.
That's why we built a global coalition with sanctions and principled diplomacy to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran. And as we speak, Iran has rolled back its nuclear program, shipped out its uranium stockpile, and the world has avoided another war.
Avoiding war, President Obama speaking in his State of the Union address this week. Obama the peacemaker. He did win the Nobel Prize in 2009. There is no award for spending on weapons, though, and spending on navies and soldiers and military satellites. But if there was one of those, Obama would win that, too.
The United States of America is the most powerful nation on earth. Period. Period. It's not even close. It's not even close. It's not even close. We spend more on our military than the next eight nations combined.
It's unknown if that applause line from earlier this week may make the Nobel Committee a little nervous about this White House peacemaker. But the president has asked Congress to approve one of the largest peacetime modernizations of the U.S. nuclear arsenal, replacing aging cruise missiles with about 1,000 state-of-the-art, stealthy, and now nuclear-armed cruise missiles. Andy Weber is former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear, Chemical, and Biological Defense with the Obama administration. Andy Weber, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, John. How are you?
Great. What does it mean to add cruise missiles to the nuclear arsenal? I know this is technically an upgrade, but it would technically add cruise missiles to the submarines and traditional land-based missiles and the airplanes that are delivery systems as well.
Well, we actually eliminated the ground-launched cruise missiles in the INF Treaty between Reagan and Gorbachev in 1987. And then President Obama retired our sea-launched cruise missile in 2011. What we're talking about today and what Secretary Bill Perry and I have come out against is a new nuclear-armed cruise missile that's launched from our bombers. We just believe that it's unaffordable and unnecessary, and the Pentagon is currently planning to buy 1,000 to 1,100 of these new nuclear-armed cruise missiles, which we think are very destabilizing.
Why do this? What is the point of doing this? Is this just the shark of weapons procurement at the Pentagon swimming out of control, or is there some real strategic consideration here about what this means for the 21st century?
Well, I think it's largely inertia. The current air-launched cruise missile is aging. It was developed in the late 70s and 1980s. It flies on a 60-year-old B-52 bomber. And we're at a point where we need to either let it age out gracefully. It's set for retirement in 15 years in 2030. And we can decide not to replace it, and that's what we're recommending. And I'm confident that President Obama, as part of his vision of a world without nuclear weapons, will make the right decision on this. It's a matter of bringing the issue to his attention. And I think he has an opportunity not just to forego this unneeded $30 billion replacement program, but also, very importantly, and this would be Nobel worthy, to lead the world in an effort to eliminate this particular very dangerous, destabilizing class of nuclear weapons, all nuclear-armed cruise missiles.
Now, you say destabilizing because they're robots, right? And there's once they're launched, they're perhaps more difficult than anything to to control on any level?
Well, once they're launched, and they may have a flight time of several hours, there's no way to recall them. But they're also destabilizing because they come in two flavors. They come with a nuclear warhead and with a conventional warhead. And the risk of miscalculation, if one of these is flying towards your country, you have no way to discriminate, to know, is it nuclear or is it not? And that could lead to even an accidental nuclear war, which would be terrible.
Do you and Perry believe this violates the 2010 Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty?
It doesn't violate the treaty because there's a loophole in the treaty called the bomber counting rule. And so each of our 60-ish bombers only counts as one warhead, even though they can carry up to 20 of these air-launched cruise missiles each. So what we think, though, the president's nuclear policy is to not develop any new nuclear weapons or military capabilities. And we believe in that spirit, he should not launch a program to develop this new air-launched cruise missile called the Long-Range Strike Option, or LRSO, that it would be more consistent with his policy of no new nuclear weapons to forego this program.
Andy Weber is former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear, Chemical, and Biological Defense Programs from 2009 to 2014. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Big science is the weapon, and the president talked about in a new war on cancer this week. The president wants a cure or a treatment to prevent and eradicate cancer once and for all.
Tonight I'm announcing a new national effort to get it done. And because he's gone to the mat for all of us on so many issues over the past 40 years, I'm putting Joe in charge of mission control. For the loved ones we've all lost, for the families that we can still save, let's make America the country that cures cancer once and for all. What do you say, Joe?
Joe Biden, that is, looked a little shocked and mouthed to Paul Ryan sitting next to him, something to the effect that the president hadn't told him yet about this new assignment. Joining us is Dr. Harold Varmus, former director of the National Cancer Institute, now a professor at Weill Cornell Medicine. Welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to hear this enthusiasm, but I'm wondering if this kind of initiative, you know, make it to the moon sort of thing works with something as complicated as cancer.
Yeah, well, I think the actual metaphor is a little misplaced because there isn't a single simple mission here. But I think what the vice president can do is to galvanize interest in the number of important new developments in cancer research that are giving us a better picture of the disease, are accelerating the development of better treatments, both drug treatments that are targeted against specific mutations that drive cancers, and new treatments that that help boost the effectiveness of the immune system in controlling cancer. In addition, it is an opportunity to bring to the public's attention a number of things that people can do to help reduce the likelihood of cancer. We have made great headways in reducing tobacco use, but there's still almost 20% of the population that smokes. We don't make effective use or as effective as possible of the human papillomavirus vaccine. We still have tanning studios in the country. There's an epidemic of obesity, and all of these things contribute to cancer in a way that would allow us to – these are preventable measures. And I do think that the vice president put in this position, a position I'm sure he was aware he was going to be assigned, because there's been much talk in the cancer gossip network about meetings with the vice president's staff and the vice president himself has been very forward about his interest in doing something about cancer. And what I like about what is being done is that there is no simple claim that we're going to cure cancer by a certain year or that we think of cancer as one disease. Instead, what the vice president has said in his own statement is that he wants to accelerate progress, and I think that can be done.
Does that involve really looping together a lot of the initiatives on the genetic front that may be working in a kind of proprietary competition that would benefit from coming together in a more coherent initiative?
Well, I think that the genetic front has actually been quite cooperative. For example, we've had – when I was at the National Cancer Institute, we had literally thousands of scientists working together on a project called the Cancer Genome Atlas. And that involved scientists taking off their personal ambition to work as a team. And that's produced a huge realm of genetic data about cancer that every scientist I know uses every day. But it does bring to the fore the places where there have been problems. And assembling clinical data, for example, it helps to explain the significance of the genetic findings. It allows us to think more profoundly about how we might conduct clinical trials in this country, which are changing in, as a result of genetic information. One thing that troubles me is that it's very expensive to do a clinical trial in which you have to obtain genetic information first. And if the vice president simply worked with the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services to encourage them to use rulings they already have in hand to help to support the costs of doing genetic analysis, making a database for both clinical and genetic data that could be used to learn new knowledge and to learn in the future what coverage of those costs is appropriate based on what we learn. We still have a lot to learn. And the vice president, without even trying to work for additional money. Money's important. Money drives the process. The increased, long overdue increase in the NIH budget this year is going to be very helpful. No doubt the vice president's enthusiasm for medical science and the president's helped.
What do you make of Vincent DeVita's book about cancer techniques, chemotherapy particularly, being misapplied in actual clinical practice? Would an initiative like this enforce more discipline on the science of the way clinical practice is done in cancer?
Well, I'm not going to respond to Vince's book. I know him well, but his book is still in the mail to me, so I haven't read it yet. But I do think that we are in a unique situation at the moment because cancers are driven by changes in our genome, and we now have the tools to analyze those. It's a little like moving from a time when we said someone had pneumonia to a time when we said they had pneumonia caused by a virus or by a specific bacterium, and you could tailor the therapy directly to the underlying cause. It is possible in the context of taking care of a patient, or even more profoundly in a clinical trial, to know exactly what one's dealing with. And not to seize on that, to use the available regulatory and reimbursement tools to make many more patients part of a study so that we are learning from everybody. We have over 500,000 deaths a year from cancer in this country. And many of those individuals who are struggling with this disease, doing better than they would have done 10 or 20 years ago, but still faced with a difficult outcome, are interested in the idea of being donors of genetic information.
And the prospect of not fearing cancer from this initiative from the president. Dr. Harold Varmus, former director of the National Cancer Institute, now a professor at Weill Cornell Medicine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Among the more popular police crime-solving tools in the movies and on TV anyway are super CSI coroners, future crime predictors, as in the movie Minority Report, and just plain psychics.
Ooh, I am getting it. And it is a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
I'm having a vision.
I can dig it.
It's not a psych out, but police forces are using the ultra-fast brains of computers merging large public information databases to bring big data tools to threat assessment for police officers called to a potential crime scene. A system called Beware, a product from a company called Intrado, can quickly assemble a vast information profile on someone simply by inputting an address or a license plate. Some versions of Beware can rank people using color codes from red to green in a threat index. In Fresno, California, cops have embraced the Beware system publicly. Other police forces around the nation are keeping this new capability secret. Fresno Chief Jerry Dyer says the color codes were too hot to handle for privacy alert citizens and politicians in Fresno, but he says Beware is here to stay.
We are generally driven by addresses. When calls come in, officers are sent to specific addresses to handle certain types of situations. So this Beware system, it targets or it's address specific, and it gives information regarding who might be there and what their history is, and allows for immediate access to it for law enforcement so that we can get that into the hands of the officers real time.
And when you say their history, are you talking just about, paperwork history, resumes, or is it, something more subtle, like, got into a fight at a McDonald's or something?
No, it's criminal history that's accessible through the courts, and it's also all commercial records. Same information that government agencies, healthcare, insurance, private investigators have access to. The difference is it merges all of these databases into one database that is automatically queried for certain types of calls, and that query is completed within about 30 seconds so that information is available to operators in our real-time crime center so that they can look at it very, very quickly and then provide information to the officers should the officers need that information to handle that call more safely.
Could Beware pull up a rant on Facebook or some social media site?
They do have the ability to monitor social media, and they utilize that as part of their threat assessment score. In the event that there were threats made, perhaps over a Facebook post or Twitter, and then what that is provided to the operator in the center is a link. If need be, the operator can access that link and see what that information is to see if it's helpful or not. And if it is, then again, that would be provided to the officer. I have to tell you, we've been testing the site for a year within our center. And there's only been a couple of times where social media links have come up in the call. And we have chosen at this point to not use that particular information. In fact, we've asked them to turn off that feature on our system because we do not want to be misled. And secondly, we have to ensure that whatever we're doing with our system meets a comfort level of our council and our community.
I hear what you're saying, that it's public information and that it's not unusual, you know, secret information or anything like that. But nevertheless, if you have the ability to merge data and, you know, get an enormous amount of data in a very, very short amount of time, it changes the information in some sense. I mean, you can act on it in a way that you couldn't act on it if you were just doing it in a library.
Right. And for law enforcement officers, we're used to receiving information and processing it very quickly. I remember when a 911 call is made to our dispatcher, they're taking information very, very quickly in an emergency situation, typing that information in the call and giving it to the officers. You know, as I've said publicly, officers are expected to know the unknown and to see the unseen and then make split-second decisions with limited facts, knowing full well they're going to be second-guessed after the fact by those people that have all the facts. So it's my responsibility as a chief to get as much information into their hands to take away some of the unknown and some of the unseen so that they can make better informed decisions.
You've been second-guessed by some, you know, big government suspicious politicians in your neck of the woods. How did that go?
Well, I think most of it had to do with the fact that as we were testing this data, we did not have good conversations with certain council members, and they were receiving information from people that were uninformed about what this system really provides. And quite frankly, the biggest concern was the social media monitoring and how that played into a threat assessment, and then the color coding and how that played into our judgments. You know, it's ironic in today's age, we end up with people that really want law enforcement to protect them from gang members, to protect them from terrorist attacks. But sometimes we don't want to give law enforcement the tools that are needed in order for them to do that. We look back here at our terrorist attack that occurred in San Bernardino. There was widespread criticism of law enforcement's use of armored rescue vehicles and militarization of police. Yet we saw firsthand in San Bernardino how helpful those rescue vehicles were when three of them were utilized to take down the suspects.
Isn't there the problem, though, with guilty until proven innocent here if you get a threat indication that's maybe at odds with the facts?
Well, we have to be careful with that anytime we have people we contact with a past criminal history because it is the past. Although the past is a good indicator of the future, people can change, and we know that and understand that as we approach these calls. It is important for our officers to keep an open mind as they handle calls and with the information that they have available to them. But it's no different than if a caller called in to the department and provided information to a dispatcher that wasn't totally accurate. Officers use that information to make decisions, but they have to be very careful and keep an open mind in terms of information may not always be 100% accurate.
Chief Dyer, thanks so much.
I appreciate you having me on the show, John. Thank you.
There are some very old churches in the French city of Calais on the English Channel, but it is a new church that is at the center of a makeshift community that has become a symbol of the migrant crisis in Europe. These North African immigrants are praying at St. Michael's Church, a tented makeshift church complete with steeple, in a tented town called the Jungle, full of people of many faiths praying to leave France and go to the UK, which on a clear day is visible across the channel.
I'm trying to get to UK.
Is this a bad place?
Very, very bad. You can see the way we live here. This is not life. So we're trying to go to a better place.
That was Yaqob, a half-Sudanese, half-Ghanaian migrant, talking with the BBC. 7,000 migrants from the Middle East and North Africa call this place home, something that has attracted anti-refugee protests in normally tranquil Calais. If the French government gets its way, the migrants in the jungle, including some Syrian refugees, will be moved into a new, more permanent facility built of shipping containers. It's the first permanent refugee camp in France since 2002. Do the refugees want to go in this time of fragile uncertainty? Caroline Gregory has been volunteering in the Calais camps for the past few months with the group Help Refugees.
Generally speaking, no. This is partly because it's very unclear as to what the conditions of them moving will be. It's unclear if that will force them to claim asylum in France. And the container camp, as it is, because it's a camp made of shipping containers, is quite dehumanising. These containers are packing in 15 people per container. The other thing that I should say is that the container camp only contains places for 1,500 people, and there are currently 7,000 refugees in the camp. So there's not going to be enough places for everybody.
Give me a sense of how many different nationalities and faiths and languages are there in the camp. We've taken a look at this church, this remarkable church, St. Michael's, which is on the edge of the camp, which is a place for a lot of North Africans. What have you observed?
That's right. Yes. Yeah, no, the church is beautiful, and it's mostly Eritreans and Ethiopians who worship there. And there is also another church used by some of the Sudanese. There are several mosques in there. The majority nationalities in there are Sudan and Afghanistan and Syria. But then there are also many people from Ethiopia, some from Somalia. Many Kurds are in the camp as well. So it's quite a strong mixture, and everyone gets on, considering, you know, the extreme stress that they're under. Everyone actually gets on really well together.
Has that stress increased since the attacks in Paris?
No, I would actually say the opposite. I would say that people have come together more since the attacks in Paris. I mean, it certainly is stressful for them because they are portrayed in the media as being potential terrorists themselves, when, of course, the truth is they are actually fleeing from ISIS and so on themselves.
Why would they have to claim asylum in France if they move to this container ship? And what is the holdup in getting them from France to the UK, where many of them would prefer to be?
We're unsure if France is placing these conditions upon them entering the shipping container camp. France is keen to encourage some to apply for asylum in France. So I think when France initially thought that the shipping container camp would be an attractive option to them, it considered putting that as one of the conditions on it. So we're not sure if that's still going to be the case or not. The difficulty is that the UK is simply not accepting the refugee status of these people and is not accepting them for asylum, is not accepting that they have legitimate asylum cases. Therefore, the only current method for these people to reach the UK is illegally, by walking through the Eurotunnel or by jumping on the backs of lorries or trains, which, of course, is very dangerous. And many have died in the attempt to get over.
Why won't the Brits take more? I don't understand why. No. I mean, these people are going to be in limbo forever.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's what we want to know as well. We have room. We have room for these people. They would be assimilated fairly fast. These people are genuine refugees. They, you know, I have seen their scars and their bullet wounds. I've seen the pictures of their bodies of their families on their phones. They are genuine refugees. And, you know, even as humans, let alone as a country, we have the responsibility to take them in.
Caroline Gregory is a volunteer for the group Help Refugees, is a journalist working in Calais, France. Thanks so much, Caroline.
No problem. Thank you very much.
On the mellow, health-conscious Upper West Side of Manhattan, where people eat kale and drink soy milk, there's a big vegan coming to the neighborhood. More bone than flesh and more replica than real, this week marks the unveiling of a Titanosaurus at the American Museum of Natural History, home of the largest collection of dinosaur fossils in the world. This Titanosaurus, a relative of the smaller Dreadnoughtus, was not a gentle vegan. Its tail, for one thing, was a real killer, says Drexel University researcher Ken Lacavera.
And so it's 30 feet altogether. And this is an incredibly bulky, massively muscled tail. Everything about this bespeaks to its power.
The scientists first found evidence of this monster in Patagonia, Argentina. And unlike a lot of similar massive discoveries, they can digitize the huge bones of this fossil so they can be easily visualized without moving them.
We're using a 3D laser scanner to capture the digital form of these bones, and then essentially we can digitally curate the fossil. This has the advantage that it doesn't take space. These images can be ported around the world to other scientists, other museums, and we can use them in biomechanical models.
Dr. Diego Pohl is here in New York, one of the paleontologists from Argentina who discovered this dinosaur. He joins me now in the studio. Doctor, did you assemble this massive skeleton from a digital file?
Yeah, exactly. We actually scan with a laser scanner the entire set of fossils we found in Argentina. So we have a digital 3D model of the entire skeleton of this dinosaur. And then we printed a copy of this model to mount the skeleton that we are showing today at the American Museum.
So it's a data set, becomes a print, becomes a model, becomes a bigger model, becomes a bigger model, becomes what we are unveiling.
Exactly.
That's great.
Yeah.
Do you have real bones there for also people to see?
Yes. We also have the femur, one of the bones in the hind limb, and then the entire forelimb.
Which is bigger than you, right?
Oh, yeah. The femur is 2 meters and 40 centimeters, so it's really, really high.
What was it like to discover this fossil? And really, the site itself is so interesting because of what must have happened there.
Yeah, the site is really unique because we found 6 animals that died in the same place about 100 million years ago. The quality of the preservations of the bones are really fantastic. So it was really, really a unique experience to be able to participate in such a fantastic discovery. The largest dinosaur ever known appearing in front of our eyes is just something very, very special for us.
And the tail of this dinosaur is a real killer, but it wasn't a predator. It was just protecting itself.
Yeah. There is this basic question is that, you know, why did they become so big? You know, why they evolved in these gigantic animals? You know, one of the reasons that we have found is that being a giant is a very good way to avoid predation. Right? Like modern-day elephants.
And it's not as though the Tyrannosaurus rexes couldn't make it to Patagonia.
Well, actually, we know there were like really, really big predators back then, you know, as big as T-Rex. But nonetheless, these animals were much, much bigger than T-Rex. You know, the skeleton is 122 feet long.
What feeling do you get standing next to this thing, and what scientifically would you want people to see and feel when they're next to this model other than just, whoa, awesome?
Well, the first thing you feel is you feel tiny, you know? that's a very, you know, universal feeling. And you immediately wonder, what was it like to be such a gigantic animal? You know, how fast they had to grow to reach that body size in 20 years or 30 years. That's probably, you know, how much it took for this dinosaur to become adult.
So that's a lot of kale.
Yeah. You know, how
leaves.
how much they needed to eat. These animals must have been like extremely voracious. I mean, they needed to eat like a huge amount of plant material per day to support their own, you know, energetic requirements, their physiology.
Now, I saw a trailer at the museum calling it Titanosaurus, and I've also heard the name Dreadnoughtus, right, from down in Argentina. But it does it have a name yet?
Yeah. No, this one doesn't have a name. So it belongs to a family, the Titanosaurs. So it is a titanosaur, this group of dinosaurs that is basically the type of dinosaur that achieved the largest body size. And this one is a brand new species. So it doesn't have an official name yet. It's going to be published, the scientific paper, very soon.
You know what it is?
Yeah.
You know the real name.
Right.
You can't tell me, though.
Yeah, I can't tell you because...
Is it Humongosaurus?
No, it's not that, but that would be a good
that's
one.
That's a good one. Like that.
Yeah, because of the way the scientific naming rules are, right. The name cannot be released before the scientific paper appears. So that's...
Oh, that's great. So we won't know it today.
Yeah, we will not.
So, all right. So finally, I read this fossil is not even full grown. Is that right?
Is that right? Yeah. By analyzing the bone tissue, you can estimate, you know, how old these animals were and if they had stopped growing or not. And we did the analysis, and this animal does not have this grown-up tissue, bone tissue
so
on
it's
the surface.
Like so, a teenager.
Yeah, probably was a teenager. You know, it wasn't a baby, certainly.
Yeah.
But they probably had room to go.
Dr. Diego Pohl, congratulations.
Well, thank you very much.
Dr. Diego Pohl is a paleontologist at the Museum of Paleontology in Egidio Feruglio in Patagonia, Argentina. Day of the Academy Award nominations, we say goodbye to actor and director Alan Rickman, dead at age 69. The Oscars typically overlook talents like Rickman's, but there were few who could touch his range and depth of performance on screen and stage.
Just another American who saw too many movies as a child. Another orphan of a bankrupt culture who thinks he's John Wayne, Rambo, Marshall Dillon.
I'm gonna cut your heart out with a spoon!
Why a spoon, cousin? Why not an axe?
Because it's dull, you twit. It'll hurt more.
I think you ought to know I'm feeling very depressed.
Well, we have something that should take your mind off things.
It won't work. I have an exceptionally large mind.
From his start with the Royal Shakespeare Company in London, he was a respected and well-known Hollywood performer playing the villains in Die Hard and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, character and comic roles in Sense and Sensibility, Love Actually, Sweeney Todd, and in the 2014 film A Little Chaos. But for legions of young fans, he will always be Severus Snape, the snide, strange-haired, reclusive potion master of Hogwarts.
Now what would three young Gryffindors such as yourselves be doing inside on a day like this?
So long, Professor Snape. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, offering resources to help ensure the last wishes of individuals are upheld through last wills, living trusts, and powers of attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.